And I think we have one person present to be admitted to the bar. Excuse me while I consult my notes here. I don't have as many notes as I usually have for this. Here we go. On behalf of myself and my colleagues, Judges Tatel and Williams, I'd like to welcome you to the attorney admission ceremony. Before you appear before this court, I think it's important that you are familiar with its distinguished history. The court was formed by Act of Congress on February 9, 1893, originally called the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. The court then comprised one Chief Justice, as the position was then called. We've been demoted to Chief Judge in the meantime, and two Associate Justices. Not until 1948 that the court was given its present name. Since its founding, the court has grown from 3 to 12 authorized judgeships and then back to 11. 57 judges have served the court, including 9 active and 4 senior judges. That's not the right number anymore. We have 8 active and 6 senior judges about to be changed when I go senior next week or next month, and we'll have another shortage among the active judges then. But of the judges who have sat, 7 have gone on to serve on the Supreme Court, Chief Justices Roberts, Berger, and Vinson, and Justices Rutledge, Scalia, Thomas, and Ginsburg. To celebrate the 200th anniversary of the creation of the first court of the District of Columbia Circuit, the Circuit Historical Society commissioned historian Jeffrey Brandon Morris to write a scholarly history of the circuit. The result was called Calmly to Poise the Scales of Justice, a history of the courts of the District of Columbia. I encourage you to read the book, published in 2001. What makes this circuit special is not just its bench, but its bar. The bar of the D.C. Circuit is made up of highly regarded and skilled advocates. Our bar members have a history of providing able pro bono assistance. The bar's pro bono service enables this court to do its work more effectively because we know the parties are receiving good legal representation. I hope you will consider participating in the court's pro bono program in the future. I'm sure that you have worked hard to get here where you are today. You should take pride in your accomplishments. As you move forward in your career, I hope you will take a moment to look back and thank those who helped you get here. In the future, we hope you will strive to help someone else starting his career or hers. We look forward to your appearances before the court. We know you will serve well the cause of justice. Raise your right hand for the administration of the oath. Please repeat after me. I state your name.
I, Charles C. Getch.
You solemnly swear.
Solemnly swear.
That I will conduct myself.
That I will conduct myself.
As an attorney and counselor of the court.
As an attorney and counselor of the court.
Uprightly and according to law.
Uprightly and according to law.
And that I will support the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States.
Thank you, Mr. Gash. You are now a member of the Bar of the District of Columbia Circuit, entitled to all rights and privileges pertaining thereto, that it be spread upon the records of the court. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's proceed.
May it please the court, Attorney Thaddeus J. Stauber, on behalf of the Hungarian government and the identified named museums in this case. This case comes before this court for the very first time, 65 years after the events which led to the facts and circumstances surrounding this claim, 20 years after the fall of communists in the now free democracy of Hungary, and almost 10 years after the start of an 8-year litigation that went on in the courts, the independent courts of Hungary, after a full and fair hearing on the issues presented with respect to the Herzog heirs' ownership claims to the artworks that are now here in dispute. I'd like to focus this court on three particular grounds, which are all, while building on each other, independent grounds of this court to grant and reverse the lower court's motion to dismiss and dispose of this case. First and foremost, this case comes before you with a treaty, the 1947 Paris Peace Treaty, a treaty that admittedly many people are not familiar with, a treaty which was signed by the Hungarian government with the Allied nations following the conclusion of World War II, a treaty which states clearly it has been signed in an effort to resolve any and all claims and disputes arising from the horrors of World War II. In particular, as it relates to the treaty signed by Hungary and Romania, the parties to the treaty, that being the Allied nations and Hungary and Romania, took great efforts to include a provision in the Hungarian Treaty Article 27, which placed the subject matter jurisdiction of claims that arose from the discriminatory acts which occurred within the Hungarian jurisdiction in Hungary.
But plaintiffs have pleaded a bailment claim.
Your Honor, I would dispute that the plaintiffs have pleaded a bailment claim.
You would dispute they've pleaded the claim?
They pled the claim, but they did not plead a claim that survives a motion to dismiss. They have not set forth...
Why is that?
Your Honor. If you look at the appendix, joint appendix...
We're looking at paragraph... Why don't we start with paragraph 36 of the complaint?
If we look at the complaint... And
this is a motion to dismiss.
This is a motion to dismiss.
Not summary judgment.
And so we stay in the confines of the complaint.
Right. Which we have to accept as true, the allegations of the complaint.
You're correct. Yes. And I would specifically address the court's attention to paragraph 69 through 73. While the Hungarian government purported to return some pieces of the Herzog collection, it largely avoided turning over physical possession of most of the Herzog collection, including by seeking to extract substantial fees and denying export permits. Hungarian government officials repeatedly harassed and threatened.
I was asking about paragraph 36.
With respect to paragraph 36, under D.C. law, which we look to, and McAvoy, you need a meeting of the minds between the parties in order to have a bailment. The plaintiffs in this case have made conclusory allegations about a bailment.
This is a motion to dismiss.
It is a motion to dismiss. Mm-hmm. And even though if we take what the plaintiff says as true, the plaintiff is purporting to base its bailment on governmental actions, which include extracting fees, harassing.
Excuse me, let me ask you a question. If this, your view is this is not, plaintiffs have failed adequately to plead a bailment, but would you agree that if the pleading was adequate, that it would not implicate the peace treaty?
No, Your Honor, I do not.
Okay.
Because if you look at the pleading on its face, all of the allegations with connection to the bailment go up to the point of time of 1948. That is immediately following and during the period of the peace treaty. The peace treaty captured the entire subject matter of claims that arise from property taken from those within Hungary's jurisdiction during World War II. The plaintiffs themselves, in their complaint, on seven occasions at Joint Appendix 24, 35, 42, 239, 271, 272, and 295, cite themselves to the Paris Peace Treaty as being the start and the basis of their bailment claim. In particular, at Joint Appendix 295, the plaintiffs state in their opposition to the motion to dismiss, finally, the 1947 peace treaty, in which Hungary agreed to restitute property looted from Hungarian Jews during the Holocaust, should be considered a treaty regarding controlling legal principles such that the act of state doctrine shall not apply. The plaintiffs themselves have attempted to utilize the 1947 treaty and the obligations that it placed on the Hungarian government to create a bailment. You may not have a bailment arising from a treaty between Hungary and the Allied nations. The 1947 treaty provides for no private party cause of action. This court, And the United States courts have made it very clear that in order for a private party to have a claim arising from a treaty, it needs to be specifically provided for in the treaty. That is not the case here. I would go on and point the court's attention to Joint Appendix 271, again at the opposition of the motion to dismiss. While plaintiff's property was taken during World War II, such that rights and property taken in violation of international law are an issue, those takings became bailments after World War II, when Hungary agreed to the 1947 peace treaty. Again, if you focus on the complaint, as we are at the motion to dismiss stage, you will find that there are no allegations with respect to the creation of a bailment after 1948. The Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act, which was passed in 1976, makes it very clear that this court of the United States must first look to international treaties or agreements which were entered into before 1976, and that is precisely the case here. In fact, in the 1950s, with the advent of communism, when the United States and the UK thought that Hungary, Romania, and Bulgaria were not meeting their obligations under the treaty, Article 2 Human Rights, Hungary was brought by the United States, by the UK, to the International Court of Justice, pursuant to Article 40 of the treaty, asking them to step forward and meet their obligations under Article 2. So the United States, the UK, and the other parties to this treaty were very clear that to the extent there are any claims arising from World War II, the parties took precaution to make sure that there was not left to the means of a domestic or a private cause of action, but could be enforced through the treaty. I'd like to focus the court on the bailment claim.
All this requires us to accept your argument that someone not a citizen of the U.S., either at the time of the relevant acts or at the time of the treaty, that such person's property rights are involved in the treaty, right?
All of this requires us to accept that to the extent that, yes, that the parties to this case, their property was within the jurisdiction of Hungary. They do not need to have been Hungarian, necessarily Hungarian nationals, but their property was within the territorial jurisdiction. And as this complaint is pled, the property is there and the people are within the control of Hungary.
But there certainly appears to be legal reason to find that, in fact, the persons protected are only persons who were U.S. citizens at the time of the act, basically.
With respect to the 1947 Paris Peace Treaty, that would not be the case, because Article 26 of the Paris Peace Treaty would address those who were nationals of the Allied nations. That would be U.S. citizens, U.K. citizens, and the like. Article 47 does not have that same requirement. Article 47 was meant to address those individuals that suffered as a result of racial discrimination, religious discrimination, the acts and the horrors arising from the Holocaust. And what distinguishes this particular case that is before you versus the Chabad versus Russia case, versus the case that I have handled in the Ninth Circuit with the Kingdom of Spain, versus the cases that have come out of Austria, is
get
that
to
we
the
have a treaty.
Get to the distinction. Quit listing cases you're distinguished from. Your time's getting shorter.
Thank you. I'd like to next address the statute of limitations.
You said what distinguishes them from, then you listed all the things that distinguish from. You haven't said what distinguishes them.
What distinguishes
them. Finish your sentence, please.
Yes, Your Honor. What distinguishes them is in this particular case we have a treaty. We have an applicable treaty. In any one of those other cases that have come before these courts throughout the United States involving art restitution, Holocaust-related claims.
And that treaty provides what?
That treaty provides that any and all claims arising from the acts that occurred during World War II related to the Holocaust in this particular case are the subject matter of the treaty. To the extent that the Hungarian government is alleged not to be complying with that treaty, Article 40 calls for the Allied nations to step forward and require Hungarians' compliance with that treaty. A fact that the Hungarians themselves, in 1993, through their independent judiciary, stepped forward and said, as a result of 40 years of communism, we have not met our obligations entirely under the Paris Peace Treaty, and we will take acts to set up compensation programs to address not only the horrors of the Holocaust, but also the horrors that were put forth on this country as a result of 40 years of communism. And they set forth a compensation program dealt to deal with both equitably and fairly all those who suffered during the war years. In addition, with respect to Hungary, they have passed legislation, as both parties will admit, that provide that such claims are not subject to statute of limitations, therefore opening up the courts of Hungary to these types of claims. Hungary did exactly what the West asked it to do. It broke from communism in 1989. It set up a separation of powers.
I'm going to appreciate your rhetoric, but you said you had three separate reasons.
Yes.
Why you should prevail. Would you give us those in three sentences?
1947 Paris Peace Treaty preempts the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act, and this court does not have subject matter jurisdiction. The plaintiffs
right,
have not.
You finish your list for the chief.
The plaintiffs
finish
have not,
your list, and then I'll ask my question.
The plaintiffs have not adequately pled a bailment claim. The statute of limitations should apply to bar not only the 11 claims which have already been barred, but 19 of the paintings, which are listed in the 1999 complaint filed in Hungary as the property of András and István, not U.S. citizens, two Italian citizens as far as we know, who, despite having notice of the proceedings in Hungary and despite being brought in by the Hungarian government so that all interested parties were there,
What makes you think that the filing of the Nuremberg complaint was necessarily evidence that there had been a final rejection of the plaintiff's effort to get their paintings back?
Well, it would be similar to if a claim was brought against the National Gallery here in Washington, D.C., yeah, and the National Gallery refused to return the painting, and the National Gallery asked the U.S. citizen, file your lawsuit here in the District of Columbia.
But suppose they were negotiating at the time, and the plaintiffs felt that filing a lawsuit would increase the pressure on the Hungarian government. I mean, you file lawsuits before, right?
I have.
Yeah, your lawsuits can be filed in order to increase the pressure on a defendant to settle. So just because the lawsuit was filed doesn't – remember, we're again at the motion to dismiss here. And the complaint expressly alleges that it wasn't until 08 that there was a final rejection of the request to return the paintings. Given that we're at the motion to dismiss, given that they've made a specific allegation – and given that, there's really nothing in the complaint that indicates that the Nuremberg litigation was filed because Hungary finally and firmly rejected their offer, I don't see how there's a problem with the district court's decision.
With respect to that issue, Your Honor, the plaintiff's complaint and the declarations that they submitted in support of their opposition to the motion to dismiss state specifically that after months of silence, after getting nowhere with the Hungarians, after not getting returns, that they proceeded to file their lawsuit.
And where is that in the complaint?
That is in the complaint.
The complaint alleges, quote, it was only in January 08 that Hungary issued its final decision that it would not honor its obligation to return the Herzog collection.
A decision?
That's paragraph 94.
That's a conclusory statement that takes an independent Hungarian judiciary's decision and says that is repudiation of the Hungarian government by the Hungarian government. Hungary has, just like the United States, an executive branch, a legislative branch, and a judicial branch.
Yeah.
To simply state that as if we were to hear, when the district court makes a decision, the United States government therefore makes a repudiation. Unlike the Chabad versus Russian case, okay, which this court is familiar with.
I understand your point. You're running out of time. I just have one more question.
Yeah, you're past your
buddy. Can I ask one more question?
Go ahead. I'm going to ask you some more questions.
Okay, good. In terms of the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act, and I realize your argument is it doesn't apply, but if we don't agree with that, I want to just ask you one question about the expropriation exception. The plaintiffs allege or argue that you rely on the domestic taking rule under that, and they say it doesn't apply because in this case it wasn't just the Hungarian government operating against its own citizens, it was operating under the control of Nazi Germany. So you had a different country. You didn't respond to that in your reply.
Well, because, Your Honor, to the extent that the Nazis or the Germans are taking from the Jews, we would agree.
Did you hear my question?
Yes.
Oh, so therefore what? You didn't respond because you agree?
Because if, in fact, it is the Germans that took.
Well, then isn't that pretty well, I mean, under the Seventh Circuit said, and I think their case law supports this, that therefore the domestic takings exception doesn't apply.
Then you have a taking by the Germans in 1944,
right.
A taking which then the property, according to the complaint, comes back to Hungary, and as we've set forth to this court, the Allied nations made a decision to return property to the countries, not to the individuals. It is then under the 44,
okay, so
under
the 47 treaty. Your whole argument then turns on our acceptance of your argument about the 47 peace treaty.
With respect to the Foreign Sovereign Immunity.
If we don't accept that, then what? If we believe that the 47 treaty doesn't control either because of the bailment or the citizenship issue, then what's your answer to the question about the involvement of Nazi Germany and the expropriations clause?
Then those expropriations occurred in 1944, uh-huh. And you would have an exception under the violation of international law.
Okay.
But that is precisely why, again, the 47 treaty was set up. But then if you have a conversion in 1944, the statute of limitations has long since run with respect to those.
What was the language you were saying a while ago about how the Hungarian government had not applied, does not apply the statute of limitations to Holocaust claims? But
in both parties, and the plaintiff in their complaint has stated that Hungary does not apply a statute of limitations to claims arising from the Holocaust.
How does that square with what you just told us about the statute of limitations having run?
The statute of limitations that is applicable in this particular case is the District of Columbia statute of limitations, which is a 3-year statute of limitations. The point there with respect to Hungary not having statute of limitations.
We're relying on D.C. law at this point.
We are relying on D.C.
That brings me to my other question. You argued in the district court forum nonconvenience as a way of court getting rid of this case. You have not mentioned that this morning. It is briefed. Are you abandoning that or?
We are not. We are not abandoning any of our arguments in respect of our briefs. We think each and every one of them is sufficient grounds for dismissal of this case at the most to dismiss.
Now, if we were to agree with you on the forum nonconvenience and the case were then to be brought in Hungary, are you telling us that the statute of limitations there the Hungarian statute of limitations would not apply to these claims?
There is no Hungarian statute of limitations that would bar these claims. Okay. The plaintiffs, just as they did.
That's the end of the answer to my question.
Thank you.
And your time ended a long time ago, so unless my colleagues have further questions, we'll hear from the Appellee Cross Appellant.
Thank you.
Police the court, Michael Schuster for the Herzog family. I'd like to begin, if I may, with the cross appeal and the district court's decision to grant comity to the Hungarian court decision in the Martha Nuremberg litigation. The district court erred. This was not an appropriate instance for the district court to grant comity to a foreign court's decision. The Supreme Court in Hilton v. Guillou said that where special reasons are shown, or where principles of international law or the comity of this country are at stake, recognition of a foreign judgment may not be appropriate. And in fact, in that case, the Supreme Court declined to recognize a judgment of a French court because there was at that time no reciprocity between France and the United States with respect to recognition of foreign judgments. Here, special reasons are present, and principles of international law and the comity of the United States are at stake.
Well, what you pled, if I recall correctly, is that the Hungarian court did not apply internationally recognized principles of due process. A claim the district court did not address, but that was what you pled, right?
We also, though, Your Honor, argued and alleged that, and certainly argued, and in any event it is a fact, that the Hungarian court's decision is substantially predicated on the 1973 executive agreement between the United States and Hungary.
That sounds like just judicial error.
Well, it's an instance where we have a U.S. district court deferring to a foreign court's interpretation of a bilateral agreement between the United States executive and the foreign executive. And I suggest that in and of itself, a U.S. district court should not defer under those circumstances.
I see. U.S. district court deferring to the Hungarian judgment.
To a foreign court.
Or, as you believe, misapplying.
Correct.
But it still sounds like judicial error, saying they should not have granted comity because it's erroneous. Granting comity presupposes you're not going to decide if it's erroneous.
Your Honor, I'm going to get to less the issue of error than some of the other facts that I think weigh against the granting of comity. But I'm saying, as a broader principle, where there's an agreement between the United States executive and the executive of a foreign country, it's not appropriate for a United States district court to defer to a foreign court's interpretation of that agreement. But here, there is considerable...
Are we talking about deferring to an interpretation, or are we talking about granting comity to a foreign judgment? You're moving it over, it seems to me, from what we're reviewing to what you'd like us to be reviewing.
Well, Your Honor, they amount to one and the same thing in the sense that the Hungarian...
No, they don't. If you're deferring, then you have some standard of deciding what you defer to, how thoroughly you defer. If you're granting comity, you're not reviewing the correctness of the decision to which you're granting comity. They're not the same thing.
Very well.
And I think you're moving from the one that they are over to the one you'd like them to be.
Let me stay with comity then.
Okay.
So, here, in the circumstances here, the United States Department, the interpretation of the 1973 agreement, fundamentally, the United States has taken the position that the 1973 agreement was entered into pursuant to principles of espousal and only settled claims of persons who were U.S. nationals at the time the claim arose and at the time that the claim was settled. That the Hungarian court, in denying Ms. Nierenberg's claims, found that they were at least in part barred by the 1973 agreement, which necessarily means that the Hungarian court set aside or disregarded the principle of espousal. But the United States State Department has gone on record, both to senators, to congressmen, to United States citizens, to the Hungarian government, and in the Hungarian proceedings, as saying that the 1973 agreement was executed pursuant to principles of espousal. And just to focus on one particular statement by the State Department, counsel for Ms. Nierenberg in 2002 asked the State Department for its view on the matter. The State Department issued a letter that it knew would be submitted to the Hungarian court. That letter said that the 1973 agreement only settled claims of persons who were U.S. nationals at the time the claim arose and at the time of the agreement. Ms. Nierenberg was not such a person. So the State Department conveyed its view to the Hungarian court. The Hungarian court took a different view. I suggest that in those circumstances, there hasn't been reciprocity. And it's not an appropriate instance for...
You've really confused me. When I read your brief, I thought that you were relying on this comedy on your allegation, to go back to what Judge Williams says, asked, paragraph 79, you allege that the trial wasn't conducted in accordance with international law and recognized standards of due process.
Your Honor, we made
now,
that...
Are you not talking about that now because you no longer believe that that's a sufficient basis to deny comedy, at least at the motion to dismiss stage?
I believe that's a sufficient basis as at the motion to dismiss stage, but we're not relying solely on that. And there is another principle that is at stake here. We do believe that we sufficiently alleged that the proceeding for at this stage of this proceeding, that the proceedings in Hungary were colored by considerations.
What in your complaint supports, for purposes of this motion, the position that Judge Tatel just asked? We all just asked you about essentially that. You're departing from the allegations of 79. What are you relying on?
Well, we did argue in the...
Never mind the argument. What in your complaint?
I don't know that in the complaint we addressed the comity issue. We wouldn't have, because it wouldn't have come up at that time. We would not have had to allege in our complaint a legal argument that the foreign court's decision should not be granted comity because it involves the interpretation of a bilateral executive agreement between the United States.
What were you doing in paragraph 79?
We were making factual allegations concerning...
You passed municipal court, then you go on down to say that not conducted in accordance with internationally recognized standards of due process or in accordance with international law?
Your Honor, we stand by that, but those are factual... Those are factual...
No, that's a conclusion of law. Actually, that part is...
Well... It's alleging facts.
It's a mixed question. That's what we can always fall back on.
It's alleging facts that can give rise to a finding. Fair enough. But we got an argument from the defendants, and we have a finding by the district court that the foreign decision should be granted comity. We did argue to the district.
Is that a finding or a holding of a conclusion?
It's a holding of the court.
Right. It's not a finding. It's...
Well, the court made certain findings, but ultimately that was...
I mean, counsel, it does make a difference. For
yes, but ultimately that was a holding.
Okay.
But what I want to come back to is the one further element for the court's consideration. The Foreign Claims Settlement Commission here in the United States is a tribunal, and the Foreign Claims Settlement Commission interpreted the 1973 agreement consistent with principles of espousal and consistent with the view that the United States Department of State took, all of which was conveyed to the Hungarian court, and none of which the Hungarian court granted comity to. There simply wasn't reciprocity when it comes to comity from the Hungarian court.
So you're defining reciprocity as the other country agreeing with us.
Exactly.
Well, all I can say is that the United States Department of State has gone on record as saying, quote,
but we didn't have a judgment of a court to be granted reciprocity.
We had the Hungarian negotiator in negotiating that agreement with the United States in 1966. The Hungarian negotiator asserted to the United States, you can only espouse claims of persons who were U.S. nationals at the time the claim arose.
All of that doesn't become a judgment of this court to this country, to which there could have been granted comity, though.
Well, there was no judgment that was taken to the Hungarian court. But in the broader context, there can be no doubt that in applying the interpretation that it did, the Hungarian court knew that it was making an interpretation that was contrary to the position taken by the United States Department of State.
Every time a court makes a decision that's contrary to somebody, counsel, I think you're defining comity.
Well, but in these circumstances, where it's an interpretation of an executive agreement and the and the disagreement is had with the view of the Department of State of the United States, that should carry some weight.
What's your response to counsel's argument that this whole case is barred by the treaty?
The 1947 peace treaty, again, it involves the principle of espousal. The United Nations countries that entered into the peace treaty in 1947 with Hungary did not and could not settle claims of Hungarian nationals who were not United States nationals at the time those claims arose. That is simply a bedrock principle of international law. The United States, in fact, in the 1973 agreement, took up claims of former Hungarian nationals who became United States citizens in the interim. And if they were citizens at the time their claims arose and citizens when the agreement was entered into, then they could be covered by the 1973 agreement. If Hungarian nationals' claims were fully and finally settled by the 1947 peace treaty, that could not have occurred. Moreover, again under the 73 agreement, both the United States Congress persons and private individuals appealed to the Department of State saying, why can't persons who were Hungarian nationals at the time their claims arose and U.S. citizens when the 73 agreement was entered into, why can't they claim under the 73 agreement? The answer was because their claims were not espoused under that agreement. The answer never was that the claims of such Hungarian nationals were resolved by the 1947 peace treaty. And that was simply not the case. The Department of State has never taken that view. Hungary has never taken that view. The defendants have pointed to all sorts of measures that Hungary implemented that supposedly covered the claims of persons who were Hungarian nationals during World War II at the time those claims arose. If those claims are fully and finally settled by the 1947 peace treaty, that's not necessary.
Now, why isn't the appellee's claim, appellant's claim of forum nonconvenience well taken?
Your Honor, the...
What makes this an appropriate case for the courts of the United States?
There is a United States citizen who is the plaintiff in this case.
That gives us jurisdiction.
There are other United States citizens who are interested parties who have assigned their claims to the plaintiff. This case is no different from the Chabad case, the Malevich case, the Kassir.
This case involves facts that occurred in Hungary involving people who at that time were Hungarian citizens. Only a descendant of them now is a United States citizen. It would presumably involve the... You made a funny face when I said
no,
that.
No, okay.
It involves presumably the application of Hungarian law. Anybody that knows anything about the case except the fact that we want this stuff that the plaintiff's going to be saying is going to be in it. Why isn't Hungary the appropriate forum for this case?
Well, Your Honor, first, it hasn't been established that that Hungarian law applies or how Hungarian law applies here. And in any case...
Everything that happened in Hungary.
Well,
right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
But in any case...
It's going to be a little bit hard to find some other law to apply, isn't it, other than the law of the place.
I mean, that's going to be made on an issue-by-issue basis. Some of the law here, clearly, some U.S. law applies. To the substantive claims, it may be Hungarian law. That you know, the U.S. courts are fully competent to apply and interpret Hungarian law.
Nonconvenience is not a doctrine of absolutism. It is a doctrine of convenience. And it seems that all of those things could better be determined by a court of the place, couldn't they?
Well, Your Honor,
I've said on cases where we've applied law of other countries, and we can do it, but it's certainly not a convenient thing to do. It's a very extraordinary thing to do, and it's when we were dealing with emerging countries in the Middle East, it was very difficult. But Hungary has a convoluted history, too, of law, and I'm not sure why this should be in the United States. We're not a world court.
Your Honor, I mean, first, Congress did give the United States district courts subject matter jurisdiction mm-hmm. over these kinds of claims. The United States district courts have... and
these kinds of claims, meaning what?
Meaning a claim brought by somebody whose property was taken during World War II by the Nazis, who is now suing here in the United States court. Yeah. And the courts here...
as I said at the start with, it's not a jurisdictional question. There is legal jurisdiction here. Forum nonconvenience is not subject matter jurisdiction, but I'm just wondering why this isn't an appropriate case for Hungary more than for the United States.
Well, the United States has an interest in this case. The plaintiffs are here. The plaintiffs are individual. There is a balance of convenience. Hungary is better to the extent there are inconveniences. The defendants are better able to weather them. The plaintiffs, one of the, you know, some of the art that's at issue here at least was pursued. It took 9 years to resolve just part of that. They don't have the same discovery.
Where was that done?
That was done in Hungary. But
all of this is in Hungary.
Your Honor, that was done in Hungary because Ms. Nirenberg thought she had to bring the claim in Hungary. There are no discovery procedures in Hungary, and that is a big part of what is at issue here. We have a claim for accounting of the art. This is the one issue where the district court's decision is evaluated for abuse of discretion. Yeah. Judge Hovell evaluated all of the private and public interest factors. Her Honor did in fact find that Hungary would not be an inappropriate or would be an adequate forum, but balancing all of the relevant considerations, the action remains here. That was a sound exercise of the district court's discretion.
I have one question. That is, with respect to the artworks that were not litigated in the Hungarian litigation, which let's assume that's exhaustion tolling the statute. What is it that tolls the statute during that litigation for the artworks not at issue?
Well, look, there was a claim by there was a claim there by one member of the Herzog family as to a certain number of works of art. As to all of the claims, there was simply not a final refusal by the Hungarian government until 2008.
The allegation in your complaint about that relates to the Nuremberg paintings, doesn't it?
Well, that allegation applies to all of the artworks. There is no artwork. There was no Hungary all along maintained.
What's paragraph 94 about?
I know my complaint well, but not well.
You don't have your complaint?
On page 29.
Yes.
I mean, 41 of the JA 29.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
What's that about?
The paragraph 94 applies to the, as on its terms at least, applies to the Herzog collection as a whole. It's not specific to the works of art that were at issue in the action brought by Martha Nirenberg.
It does refer to portions of the Herzog collection.
Yeah.
In the second line, second clause of that allegation.
Well, the first paragraph, the first sentence says that they commenced negotiation for the return of portions of the collection, but it goes on to say Hungary misled the heirs into believing it accepted their ownership rights to the collection. Uh-huh. At no time prior to 2008 did Hungary assert ownership rights to the collection. Throughout the period of time when efforts were made to have discussions and negotiations with Hungary, Hungary always recognized in principle that it had an obligation to return the art. At no time did Hungary say that we own the art, you can't have it back. It never made such a statement, not with respect to the paintings at issue there, not with respect to any portion of the Herzog collection. And both in private discussions with representatives of the Herzog family and in public pronouncements, the Hungarian government maintained a posture of, we're just trying to establish which of the Herzog family members really owns the art, and we have to work through the various things we have to work through, but we recognize our obligation to restitute art taken during World War II, and we recognize your ownership rights in the art.
Someone must have been taking the position that, first place, there was adverse possession, and in the second place, there was preemption by the proceedings under the 1973 convention.
Your Honor, all I can say is that is not in the record. We certainly didn't plead that, and Hungary hasn't put that into the record. And that would not belong in the record on an issue of statute of limitations at this stage. The question really is, did we plead our way out of a claim at this stage by setting forth facts in the complaint that show that the claim is time-barred? We have not done that, and no other facts were brought into or properly could have been brought into the record on that point.
If there are no further questions, again, your time has long since elapsed.
It is.
We'll give the appellant cross appellee back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors. With respect to the comedy issue, it's an abuse of discretion standard. I think the court has grasped the issues that are before us, and I don't think there's much need for further discussion on that. I would like to point out that
it is an abuse of discretion standard, but you may have higher priority uses for your 2 minutes.
Thank you. There is also the political question, which we have raised, and the political question is particularly important here.
Now, you rise in rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. I'll focus my rebuttal.
Okay.
With respect to the forum nonconvenience and the issue of the Italian plaintiffs, at paragraph 40 of the complaint, the plaintiff notes that in 1940, when the Baroness died, the collection was divided amongst the three heirs in 1940. Then, in 1999, when they filed their complaint, they specifically list 19 works being owned by Andras or Istvan. Then, contrary to what counsel has said, in support of their opposition to their motion to dismiss, they submitted three declarations from counsel who represented them in Hungary. At Joint Appendix 299, the plaintiffs specifically state that Andras and Istvan and their heirs are not in privity with Martha Nuremberg. That is a litigation that she pursued in furtherance of her own interests with respect to those particular works. The plaintiffs can't now, many years later, come and attempt to bootstrap onto a modern-day action here in the United States. When you take away the 11 paintings, which have been already dismissed with respect to comedy, and you take away 19 paintings, which are not owned by any U.S. representative, you really have no interest in the United States here with respect to this case. I would submit, in fact, the interest would more strongly be in Italy, if not Hungary or elsewhere. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.